Welcome, Gunslingers, to another episode of Narrative Gunslingers, where we talk to creators about the power of narrative in their lives.
As always, your show hosts are Travis Webb and myself, Greg Smith.
Today our guest is Todd Goldberg. Hey, Todd.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Pretty good.
You guys doing all right? Doesn't feel like America's crumbling around you? You feel fine? Everything's good?
Well, you know.
Well, yeah. This is what day we are. The stock market's interesting today.
Very interesting.
Oh, yeah. I just bought $5 million worth of GameStop just to keep the story going. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, man. So that's a red hot hashtag today. I was like, wow, so what you're saying today is you're not happy that people are buying stocks?
You know, this is what I have learned in the course of, say, the last, well, we're going to say 4 years and about 6 days, which is that if I want to be disappointed in the human experience, I will go on Twitter for about 5 minutes. And I will actually click to see what's trending, and then I will just put my head in the oven. Like, Sylvia Plath wouldn't have lasted at all in the time of social media. She'd been, like, on Twitter for 5 minutes, be like, so they're upset that people are buying? Okay, just turn on the oven. Just go. Oh,
it's over.
Yeah, it's like, oh. Why even bother with this crap? That's how I'm doing, guys. That's how I'm doing.
Okay. Noted. He's at Plath levels.
Well, I was just thinking, like, I follow Sylvia Plath's Twitter, which is, you know, she's dead, right? But there's a Twitter account. There's a ghost Twitter account that posts little things that she would say. And I realized it's been really quiet, so I'm wondering if her Twitter committed suicide.
Oh,
we're going to get burned for that later.
It's probably just being run by Herman Cain's family. Nothing to worry about.
Oh, my God. This show.
Hey, look, yeah. You invite a gunslinger on, expect a few bullets to fly.
Pew, pew, pew. It's already starting, folks.
Oh, man. All right, Todd, for audience, tell them who you are and what you've done.
Well, you know, I am. I was born the son of Byford, the brother of Al. Oh no, I'm sorry. That's Real McDaniels from Run DMC. I am your garden variety New York Times bestselling author of 13 books of fiction. That's who I am, including the new book, The Low Desert, which comes out on February 2nd. So by the time you're listening to it, the book will have already been out and been collecting rave reviews from across the world. You'll be very excited to be hearing from me. In addition to that, I host the wildly popular podcast. And by that, I mean it's actually popular.
Unlike us. Dig!
Literary Disco, along with my dear friend, the actor, writer, Strong, and the essayist and radio personality, Julia Pistel. So that's another part of what I do. I'm also a professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, where I founded and direct the Masters in Fine Arts in Creative Writing and Writing for the Performing Arts. I'm a critic, and I do a little mime. You know, I dabble in the mime arts.
All right. You should show us.
I'm actually frightened of mimes, and there's a great story by Brian Evanson. I don't know if you guys are fans of Brian's, in his collection of short stories, Fugue State, and I just love the story. It's about a woman who's, you know, she's battling depression, and things in her life aren't going well, and she finds herself hooked up with a mime for a one-night stand, and it goes, as you might imagine, really poorly. And she wakes up in the morning, and the mime is gone, but he's left his box. And so she spends the rest of the story with this invisible box that the mime left on top of her. And she's got to go chase down that goddamn mime, get his box back. It's one of the greatest short stories in the history of American literature.
That's pretty good.
It's good.
Oh, man. Well, tell us a couple of past works, and then let's talk a little bit about The Low Desert after that.
Sure. So, you know, I write crime fiction. I typically write about bad guys. So my last two books, or three books, I'm sorry. I'm just learning English. So my last...
Words taste like peaches.
I've got my second language.
of my 13 books, three of them are in the same universe that The Low Desert's in, which is based on a novel I wrote that came out in 2014 called Gangsterland, which is about a Chicago hitman who goes on the run and hides out in Las Vegas as a rabbi, though he is not Jewish and clearly is not a rabbi. and so Gangsterland came out in 2014, and then the sequel, Gangster Nation, came out in 2017. And then The Low Desert is coming out in just a couple days. In addition to that, I wrote a big best-selling book with my dear friend Brad Meltzer called The House of Secrets. And I wrote five novels based on the television show Burn Notice. That was a lot of fun. My friend Matt Nix created the show, and he asked me if I would turn it into a series of novels, and that was a super fun thing to do. And then I also wrote two other short story collections and two other novels, you know, 20 years ago now. My God. So I've been in the game since Honeys was wearing sassoons, as Dr. Dre once said. My first book, yes. My first book came out in 2000 when I was 29 years old, and I just had my 50th birthday the other day. So I'm feeling the passage of time right now, guys. It's sitting on me like a mime box.
Oh no!
So you know, I've done all that stuff, you know, and it's been great. You know, my career is sort of exactly what I wanted it to be. I always wanted to write the kind of crime fiction I'm writing now. And to be perfectly honest with you, I don't think I had the skill set to do what I'm doing now until about, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. And the fortunate thing is that my audience has grown as my skills have matched my ambition. So that's nice. So I'm probably best known these days for the Gangsterland books.
Yeah, that's an important note for our listeners is that what you just said about your skill set coming out and having success when your skill set meets your ambition. I think a lot of writers, you know, they get a lot of ambition when they're younger and their skill set doesn't match and they go, well, I'm not successful. Well, your skill set hasn't quite caught up to what your ambition is yet. And you just got to keep writing every day, you know?
Yeah. And, I mean, I don't necessarily believe in writing every day because then you're just a boring fat dude who sits there and writes all day.
Yeah. How did you know?
Like, I mean, look, you got to live. If you want to write about the human condition, sitting alone in your house, eating Cheetos and drinking, you know, gallons of coffee and you know, writing is not going to teach you how to be an empathetic human being who's able to convey other human beings in a realistic fashion. So I go for long periods of time without writing. Also, there's a lot of great television, and I like video games. So there you go.
So I'm getting rid of my Cheeto. My Cheetos on order, and they're not going to be coming anymore.
Staring at my coffee mug.
Yeah, but I'm going to tell my wife it's okay that I can play more video games because Todd said it's cool.
Yes, so, that's correct. All right. That's correct.
Oh, that was awesome. Well, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about The Low Desert, your upcoming book.
Sure. So The Low Desert is a collection of 12 short stories. Most of them take place in and around Palm Springs, which is where I live. For listeners outside of Greg and Travis's house, Palm Springs is a city in California where they hold a concert every year called Coachella.
We're gonna tell our listeners that since most of our listeners go to Coachella.
Perfect. I grew up here in the desert, but and also in Northern California. So when I was a kid, my mom was a journalist in Northern California, and my dad was in TV news up there as well. And then my mom, they divorced when I was very young, thank God, because they hated each other and were ill-suited to be married and ill-suited to be parents. But my mom, when I was 14, got a job in Palm Springs being a society columnist. But our families had been coming down to Palm Springs for many, many years. Our grandparents had houses down here because for many years, Palm Springs was the only place where Jews could golf. So my family were all up in the Pacific Northwest and Seattle and Longview and Walla Walla and Portland, places like that. And they would come to the desert. So it was sort of a natural progression that my mom, when she was looking to leave the Bay Area, ended up in Palm Springs. So, you know, I have this real affinity for this area. And I moved back here as an adult about 21 years ago. And, you know, for me, the desert is sort of like Fargo without the snow. You know, there's a lot of strange characters who roll through a resort town, and I've always been fascinated by them. And so, you know, I knew that I wanted to do a collection of short stories after my last book, after Gangster Nation, for a couple of reasons. The first being is that I was really tired. I'd written Gangsterland, The House of Secrets, and Gangster Nation back to back to back. And both, all three of those books are in my computer are over 450 pages long. So I'd written a lot of stuff in a very short period of time. And I was just super burnt out, to be perfectly honest with you. And at the same time, Gangsterland and Gangster Nation had been optioned for a TV show, and which I'm working on it now. And I tell you who I was working with, but then they'd sue me and I'd have to give back all the money.
All those NDAs.
Yeah. I can tell you that it's a large streaming company called Amazon owns the rights to it. So at any rate, I was working on the TV show and we've been working on it for a while. And I knew that I wanted to expand the Gangsterland universe, but I wasn't ready to write another novel yet. I'd started writing it and I wasn't enjoying it. You know, you never want to sit down to work and feel angry about this thing that you've created, you know, like, I have this great champagne problem that I've created this pretty amazing character in Sal Cupertine / the Rabbi David Cohen and have had great success with these books. And I didn't want to be mad at myself for sitting down and spending 18 months finishing up that story. And I found myself feeling like, oh God, I got to go back and write about this same guy again. And so writing the short stories in the Low Desert allowed me to look at minor characters from the books, create new characters outside of the books, and also examine what I imagine will be a project that I work on pretty soon, which is a series of stories about organized crime at the Salton Sea in the 1960s, which is the basis of the title story, The Low Desert. And so, you know, I spent about a year and a half working on the stories, which, you know, is about the same amount of time it would take me to write a novel. But I really found great joy in it, you know, because I was able to really expand my horizons, try on different styles, try on different attitudes when I was writing also. Because when you write the same character for a really long time and in really long books, you know, it's like having a really good steak every single day. Like at some point you're like, can I get some Bearnaise sauce?
Macaroni and cheese?
Can I get something to dip on this? And this really allowed me to get that Bearnaise sauce that I've long wanted. And the really amazing thing, and I'm upset that you guys haven't found this out yet in your extensive research about me, is that it's gotten the best reviews I've ever gotten in my entire life. And all of a sudden, this thing that I thought would just be sort of a sideline is blowing up into something that I could not have imagined, which is a nice surprise.
You know,
that is nice.
That is exciting. I was going to point something out. We're always trying to, you know, literary, you know, gunslingers, narrative gunslingers. Your story reminds me a lot of, and you might be familiar with this, but Leslie Chartis's Follow the Saint. Towards the last, he did that. That was an anthology set, and right before the last story of that anthology, he wrote almost the same kind of story that led him to write Follow the Saint, which to be an anthology. That, you know, he'd written 80 books of Simon doing Simon stuff, and he was going to write these little. And that's actually one of the more popular Saint novels, is Follow the Saint. So I think it's interesting that both you and one of my favorite other writers of a crime guy, you know, both came to that conclusion at one point in your careers.
Yeah, you know, the thing about the short story, I think about it, and not as it relates to my own work, but sort of how the world consumes short fiction, is it's really like a fine art. Like, the average reader does not say, oh, I'm going on a cruise. Well, not that anyone's going on any cruises, but in the olden days, they wouldn't say, oh, I'm going on a cruise. I'm going to go pick up a book of short stories. You know, they're going to go pick up, you know, a Clive Cussler book or something. And so you really have to want to read a short story. Like, you want to go to a museum and look at a painting hanging on a wall. And what I've always tried to do with my own short fiction, and particularly in the stories here, is understand what that reader is thinking and subvert that a little. So in this book, you know, the way that the stories are stacked together, it reads like it's a novel. You know, the ebb and flow of the drama, the ebb and flow of the emotion, the change in characters, the reoccurrence of characters, the way I've organized the stories in sort of the Minority Report at the end when I was, you know, moving them all around with my hand, was to try to simulate what it's like to actually read a novel, even though you're reading short stories. And that's just to, you know, it's just to change the experience a little bit. And hopefully that works for me.
So is there like a, just based on what you just said, is there a constant theme in each story, or like a MacGuffin that's following through each of the individual stories, other than Palm Springs, of course?
Let me ask you guys an important question.
Okay.
This is for both of you. Have either of you ever walked into a bookstore and gone up to that circular counter in the middle where there's a guy named Trent? He's always named Trent. And said, "Hey, Trent, can you recommend a book with a good theme in it?"
Why, actually.
I want to say yes so bad, but you know I can't. It's so evil.
Have you ever walked up to the other counter and said, "Excuse me, Lorraine, can you point out a book with a fucking awesome MacGuffin in it?"
God damn it!
Come on, dude.
Like, we have a new class on the show. Damn it, God.
When you guys sit down to write, are either of you thinking, "Well, I better hit that theme today, or I'm not going to get into bed"? Come on. Yep.
Well, to be fair, I actually do stress about that, but not as much as I want to be able to brag right now. I'm totally going to crawl into a corner now.
Now, see, here's the thing. Like, you know, you've gotten me on a day where I am Professor Goldberg, and you just asked me a question that a workshop student would ask on day one. How do you find your themes? How do I find my themes? Some English teacher reads my story and tells me what my theme is.
Damn it.
You don't have a theme board with a theme wheel?
Yeah.
I thought everybody did.
It's all pictures of Army Hammer. That's all it is. Just
one picture of a bit off arm. I mean, oh, God. Yeah.
I can't wait till this cookbook comes out. Oh, God.
She's wrong. That's God, terrible.
So I'm sorry. I should delete that. I
should to answer your question outside of that, I mean, there is, of course, a thread that runs through this book. And there's a front note, which is a line from the Talmud, which is a book the Jews know. And it's the line says, "A prisoner cannot free himself." And so that's sort of an overarching principle that I'm writing about. You know, I like I said, I tend to write about what you might normally consider a bad guy, right? I don't write about a lot of heroes. And so I'm writing about people really at the end of their rope who have been, you know, forced to face up to the consequences of their actions. And the other side of it is that I want you as the reader to inexplicably find yourself liking that person. And so that is the connective tissue that runs through this, is bad people doing bad things to worse people. And somehow through the characterization that I'm doing, you're going to find yourself rooting for the people that you would run away from if you saw them on the street. And, you know, I think I've probably done that throughout my entire career, you know, write about people like that. Because I'm interested in people who are wild cards. Like, you know, a cop or a detective, or when I was writing about Michael Weston from Burn Notice, like, they're going to act in predictable ways. They're going to act in a way that is closest to how they perceive the law to be. And that has, you know, that has margins and a ceiling and other cliches. And I want my characters always to have every single option available to them. If they need to shoot a guy in the back of the head to get out of a situation, they're going to do it. If they need to narc out someone, they're going to do it. If they need to just run like hell, they're going to do it. But at the end of the story, what I'm hoping you're going to find as a reader is that you have some sort of grudging empathy for that person.
That sounds like a great story.
Yeah.
Sorry, my my little son here wanted in the room.
Oh, no.
Because he heard me on a podcast. That seems to be a thing for him. Like, oh, a podcast. Meow, meow, meow.
Now we're going to hear Travis screaming at some point because he's going to get a bunch of claws in his leg or arm or face.
See, my dog, Rube Goldberg, and this is the thing, guys. If you have a chance to name your dog Rube Goldberg, you take that. My dog, Rube Goldberg, she understands when she hears me explaining the meaning of MacGuffin. That's her time. That's her time to wander into the backyard and see if there's any coyotes that she can commune with.
Oh, man. I'm never going to
let that down. okay, just checking to see if the other one was on in hand here. All right, so the Low Desert comes out when?
The Low Desert comes out February 2nd at 12:01 a.m. It will be available everywhere. And I'll be doing events all over the place. And by that, I mean from exactly where I'm sitting right now and other places inside my house. It's a weird time to have a book out, guys. I got to tell you, having been doing this since, the year 2000, there's these rhythms, right, that you sort of get used to. Like, okay, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. Well, I know that a week after my book comes out, I'm going to be in a Courtyard Inn in St. Louis eating a cheeseburger in my underwear, bemoaning the 9 people that showed up to the book signing or whatever. And I don't get that Courtyard Inn experience this time around.
you're now sitting in your own house, pantsless, with a nice shirt on, doing a Zoom meeting, chatting it up with the 5 people, and now you have to eat your cheeseburger in your own kitchen.
That's the thing. Like, I got to Instacart my grief. Oh, that's a good line. That's
trademark Todd Goldberg.
Yeah. Hey, you add that to the CV. Created Instacart my grief.
Nice, nice.
Oh, man. No, we understand. Like, we're, for us, we do a lot of cons. And this has been weird for us because we had a release this year. And we were all ready. Like, we released right as this was happening and had a con coming up. And we're supposed to be at the con talking at it, having booths and doing all our normal things that we do all the time. And not only did COVID hit and cancel the very first con and almost derail our release, but I got COVID that first week.
Oh, God.
So it was like, wow, that's awesome. We totally get you, and just not being able to network and hang out with your other creator friends. And I mean, really, I think that's kind of why these podcasts have blown up this year, because all of our creator friends this year also started doing podcasts. I know Disco, but
Hey, look, the nothing is. Let's just be clear. I don't want to brag, but have you guys been called the best literary podcast by both the Washington Post and inexplicably Good Housekeeping? No, you have not.
Not even close.
They like our last show.
We have a listener.
I didn't even know Good Housekeeping is still in business. We're angling for Red Book.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Get in there.
But you guys are so right. Like the getting together and bullshitting is really what is missing from this whole period of time. And, I miss my friends and my family, of course, terribly. And but what I really miss in this stage of book promotion, all that, is like, I've got a bunch of friends with new books out, and there's nothing better than, everyone's in Chicago inexplicably on the same 3 days. And you get to sit around in a bar and talk about, whatever is going on, and running into your pals in different places, because this job is solitary enough. And so it's when you get to promote stuff, that's the cool part. And I also just love to see the fans, like to talk to the fans and have them, some of them hug me and some of them not touch me. I miss all that stuff. Because the thing is, after 15 books, when I have a new book come out and I go to a city, I see these same people over and over and over again. And that's not something I take for granted. You know, that's people that have bought me my house. And I miss that. You know, I miss that interaction. I miss that one-on-one time. And I miss knowing that when I'm sitting here writing these books, that the other side, the people reading it, are real and not just a series of stars on Goodreads. Not that I ever look at Goodreads, because I don't want to have to pay more for my therapy appointments.
Right. Oh, so true.
I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, if you want to find out everything that you think is bad about yourself, hey, look, it's 2 a.m. Goodreads is open.
Yeah, somebody that doesn't understand what was it you wrote, and they're like, "Where's the MacGuffin?"
Yeah. yeah, like that, like that. Yeah,
I didn't understand the theme. Like, what kind of wheel were you using?
Like that.
Oh, Greg, yeah. I hate you right now. I hate you so much. Revenge for me just beating you up for so many shows in a row. You're like, go to the goal line.
I'm sorry. I'm Team Todd right now.
Damn it, all that bullying I've done all this time is coming back at me. Damn you, Todd!
Look, if I ever write a cozy crime novel about a caterer who finds a dead body, I will shove a fucking MacGuffin into that. As long as I'm writing hitman novels about a fake rabbi, you're not going to find any MacGuffins. I regret to inform you.
I get it. I was just looking for a trend or something, you know, trying to find something to sell.
When I get off this show, I got to tell you guys, there's a series of people I'm going to call. And the first thing I'm going to say is, you're not going to believe what this dude asked me.
Oh, please don't call my agent. In fact, just scrub that part of the show so he doesn't hear it.
Oh, God.
It's got to stay in, Travis. It's got to stay in.
Got to stay in. Oh, my God. Yeah. I'm nesting it into every joke I tell, so you'd have to delete this whole thing, which I understand. So
the MacGuffin is literally the MacGuffin of the show at this point.
Oh. It is the MacGuffin.
Oh, God.
So, time for the literary gunslinging narrative part that I just messed up. I'm on my A game right now. So, tell us about a story in media that inspired you to become the writer or creator you are today.
There's a couple things, actually. So, I'm going to talk about two things. The first is an actual touchstone of my literary life, which is Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck. So how this book came to have such a huge role in my life is 37-fold. So guys, re-up your subscription to Zencastr. We're staying in for a while.
Okay.
So I'm profoundly dyslexic, and when I was a kid, I couldn't read. I didn't really learn how to read until I was about 10 years old. And once I was able to read, I just, you know, I started spending all of my time at the library. I was there constantly, and the library was not far from our house in Walnut Creek. It was close enough that I could ride my bike. And I went to the Walnut Creek Library, and closer to 11. I was in the Walnut Creek Library, and I was just sort of poking around and looking at stuff. And I grabbed my usual handful of ghost hunting and paranormal psychology books. And then, for some reason, I stumbled on Of Mice and Men. And I pulled it off of the shelf. I remember this so vividly. And I just sat down, and I just started to read it. And I don't know if you guys have read Of Mice and Men recently. It's written very simply. You know, Steinbeck, he omitted useless words to an effect that makes, you know, Raymond Carver look like a maximalist. He was very minimal in his prose. And the story is a very simple one. You know, it's two guys that are basically crooks, and they're running from the law, the press, and the parents. That's a line from a Beastie Boys song. And they, you know, they end up getting a job working at a farm. And, you know, Lenny, who is suffering from some form of lack of mental acuity, you know, he has this dream of tending the rabbits, and, you know, everything goes south. And I started reading that book in the library, and I was like, well, I need to have this book. You know, I need to check this book out. And so I went up to the front counter to check out the book, and the librarian said, like, she gave me all the ghost hunting books. That was no problem. But she wouldn't let me check out Of Mice and Men. She said, it's too old for you. And I was like, it's not an R movie house. Like, it's not X. What's going on? But she wouldn't let me check it out. So what I did is I stole it.
Oh, breaking the law.
Yeah, I was a scofflaw from a young age. And I brought it home and I read it. And it was the first book that made me cry while I read it. And it's the first book that made me understand that there can be empathy in violence. You know, at the end, George kills Lenny in a mercy killing. He shoots him in the back of the head because a mob is coming to get him, led by this evil ranch hand named Curly. And it really caused me to question all these things that I had been taught about stories and narrative and heroes and all that stuff. You know, Of Mice and Men is really a crime story. And it, you know, takes place in Northern California, where I was living at the time. So I was familiar with the landscape. It just had a super profound effect on me. And so then I turned around, I read it all over again. I mean, the book's 165 pages. It's very short. And every time I read it, I found something new, and it made me want to tell stories. And, you know, I already had, you know, like 50,000 Star Wars action figures, what we would commonly call dolls. And, you know, I would lay them around my bedroom, and I'd tell loosely based Star Wars stories based on these characters. But then I started telling, like, Of Mice and Men based stories with these characters, like, oh, Luke is now a farmhand, and Han is his buddy, and they gotta kill Princess Leia, or, you know, like, whatever it might be. Like, all of a sudden my view of narrative went from this fantasy world that I had mostly seen in movies because I couldn't read, and or in television because I couldn't read, and all of a sudden I was having this emotional experience from books. But then what happened is my mom found all of my stolen books, because I also stole the Ghost Hunter books, and she was like, "What are all these books?" And I should tell you, my mom was a crazy person, and I mean that in every sense of the word. She was verbally abusive, not physically abusive, but a very abusive woman, and not a very nice person. And her anger and her rage was frightening. You know, it was horrible. But she was a writer and a journalist, and she had taught and imbued in each of us, me, my brother Lee, who's also a novelist, my two sisters, who have published, you know, six books between the two of them also, but not fiction, a real love of books and literature and of storytelling. And she saw all these books and she said, you know, where the hell did you get these? And I was like, I stole them from the library because the librarian wouldn't let me check them out. And she was like, grab all these goddamn books and get in the car. And I was like, oh God, I'm like, that's it. I am done for. And so we drive over to the library and I've got all these books, and my mom says, who didn't let you check these out? And so I point at the aged librarian, who is probably, you know, 26. And my mom drags me up there and she pulls out all the books from my backpack and she sets them on the counter. And she's like, are you the person that said he couldn't check out these books? And the woman's like, yes, I am. And my mom says, every single book in this library, every single book is appropriate for my son. Every single one. And she slid those books back in the bag and off we went. I still had never checked those books out. And to this day, you guys, I still have that copy of Mice and Men on my shelf. It's been overdue from the Walnut Creek Library since 1981. But that experience with my mom and that experience reading that book, that's the double-sided of this thing, these two things, really influenced the way I write, because I want to write stories where there's violence, and where that violence is not a cartoon, where that violence has a real world cause and effect, where you throw a pebble in the water And when that ripple hits the shore, there's a real problem with it. And I want to write about things where a character acts in a way that you think is going to be one way, but it's the other way. And that was my mom. You know, I expected my mom to be who she had been my entire life. But in that moment, she became a hero for a very brief period of time. And that taught me a lot about setting up expectations in readers and storytelling in general, but also that even someone who I didn't feel like loved me, and maybe she did and maybe she didn't, you know, you'd have to ask her, but we'd need to get a Ouija board, cared about my desire and love of literature. And that meant something also completely different, that a person can, as Whitman said, contain multitudes, and they don't always line up with your expectations.
Talk about fight for your right to read.
Your mom caught you smoking and she says, no way.
Yeah. I was thinking your mom caught you reading and she said, no way. Right.
That
where are these Faulkners coming from?
That hypocrite reads Faulkner all day.
Oh, man. Wow, that was a really good story, Todd.
Yeah.
Storytelling professional over there. Like, questions went out the window. So the only question I really had all set up, you answered at the end when you came back to the librarian, just like, do you think the librarian was happy that you stole the book or sad? And you're like, my mom came back and told the librarian to fuck off.
Yeah. It was a good moment, man. I got to tell you, it really was. And, you know, the funny thing is I've gone back to that library over the years. Like, I'll be up in the Bay Area for an event or something. And I walk in that library and I'm like, and I always just think, like, is this the day they grab me?
Do you think the librarian still works there?
Oh, God. I'm sure she doesn't, because now she'd be all of 48 years old. I mean, in my mind, this librarian was like 200 years old, but she was probably literally like 27, right? I mean, isn't that the thing? Like, when you think about your elementary school teachers, you're like, oh, my God, they were so old. You're like, oh, yeah, they were probably 30.
Yeah. I just or, had to talk. Younger. You remember, you know, Fast Times at Richmond High, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what's her name? The actress.
Phoebe Cates?
So when I was a kid, Phoebe Cates seemed like an old woman, right? She just seemed like the oldest woman ever, right? Now I'm like, look at that little girl. She looks so young in this. That's so creepy. They're looking at her this way. And I'm like, wait a minute. What happened here? Where did I skip the part where she's hot and my age?
Yeah, that is a little disconcerting, isn't it? Like when you watch these movies that made you feel a certain way in your youth and you're like, oh, I'm looking at it again, I'm 50 and that's a 20-year-old person. This is probably not legal in some country or Utah. It's funny though, like, you know, the things that imprint on you at a young age, you know, the memory has an interesting way of distorting reality, of course. And so that person will always be old to you, no matter how old they actually were.
It's just like, you know, I think I'm the same age my parents were when they became grandparents now, and that creeps me out.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot. Yeah. I'm the same age now when my mom was dating a lounge singer named Anthony Shane. I think about that sometimes.
The hardest thing now at this age is I used to own a nightclub, and I've been partying since I was like 13, 12, you know, going to the raves and stuff. So this nightclub, and I had a friend that I've known since I was 13 or 14 come to my nightclub. I hadn't seen her in a couple of years. So she shows up to my nightclub, and in my mind, she still looks pretty much the same. We're in our mid-30s at the time. And she's like, I want you to meet my daughter. She's old enough to come in your club now.
Oh, boy.
And I was like, what? You can't serve her drinks. That was bad. So,
well, but you're also at the age, or at least, you know, this keeps happening to me where I start screaming at the children of athletes that I rooted for when I was a kid, like, oh, that fucking guy, he's fucking up like Mitch Richmond did when I was rooting for Mitch Richmond. He's Mitch Richmond Jr. Like, oh, God, I've been talking crap to a television version of this guy's DNA for 35 years.
All right. So let me see here. Let's talk. So, man, you went through a really good explanation of Mice and Men. I can't tear that book apart because the last time I read it was in ninth grade. And I only remember, oddly, you brought up all the key moments I could remember, and that's all I can remember.
Well, those are the main plot points. I mean, it's a very, very short book. I mean, you can read it in 2.5 hours. I mean, I read it as a 10-year-old or 11-year-old, you know, half at the library and half at home. And it was, you know, I finished it in time to watch The Monkees.
Yeah. That's a good amount of time. Yeah. Were there any moments outside of the moments you brought up that you think really held to you all these years later? Like something that you think other readers would have a moment with that wouldn't be too much of a damn it, that'll be a spoiler. The book's 100 years old now, right? Is there spoilers still?
Yeah, you can't spoil Of Mice and Men. You know, it's a funny thing. I think about it more, not in relation to the plot points, but where this book exists in sort of the canon of American literature. And where crime fiction in general, which is, you know, what I prefer to write, but not always what I prefer to read, how the ghettoization of genre fiction doesn't always line up with the reality of what books are and what the history of books are. So when you say, like, oh, I write crime fiction, there's a presumption that, oh, that's only just what you read when you're on vacation. And then you say, like, oh, did you ever read that book about that guy who murdered his best friend when there was a mob coming? And they're like, that book sounds vaguely familiar, and you're like, it's called Of Mice and Men, you bastard. Or like, did you ever read that book about that guy who pretended to be another guy because he was working for this gangster and he was in love with this woman who lived across the dock, and he brought on this rube to try to help sway her affections, and they ended up killing a guy, and then there was a murder, and then the main character, he ends up dead in a pool. They're like, oh, that sounds like The Great Gatsby. But it's because that is The Great Gatsby. And so, you know, I am fascinated by this notion that what we view as literary fiction, what we view as genre fiction, is typically separated by the perception of quality, not the perception of the reality of the storytelling. So a book like Of Mice and Men, a book like The Great Gatsby, a book like To Kill a Mockingbird, which is the you know, the foreshadower of a generation of legal thrillers, you know, there's no John Grisham without Harper Lee. And so I think about Of Mice and Men when I'm writing my brand of genre fiction, because the secret sauce in Of Mice and Men, and hopefully the secret sauce that's in The Low Desert out February 2nd at booksellers everywhere, is that you find yourself wondering what it would be like to be in these people's shoes. I mean, and that's the essence of empathy, right? You know, and I think people oftentimes when reading sort of commercial crime fiction, they pity the victims. They feel sympathetic to the victims, so they don't feel empathetic to the victims. And the difference between those two things as it relates to writing fiction and what Of Mice and Men does so well is that you never pity anyone of In Mice and Men. You read that book and you say, you know, but for the grace of a God I don't believe in, that could have been me. You know, I could have been in that situation. And it's not required that that situation happened in the 1930s in a small farming town. You know, you might be surprised to learn that there's dangerous mobs of people who will kill you in any town at any given time. They might even storm the Capitol if they disagree with your thoughts and feelings.
Wild.
That's the germ that has come out of Mice and Men that I have found has infected my work all this time. You know, this entire time that I've been writing stories and novels, it's been that idea that this could be you, and that finding empathy in these people's lives is the key to making a connection to the readers. And I've been fortunate, knock on the wood at my desk here, that for 21 years of my writing life, that's been true. People have been buying my books and reading them.
What I'm picking up is that I don't want to be chased by a mob with you because chances are you're going to put me down with two shots to the back of the head.
Yeah, no, I will put you down. Not even a, look, dude, if the question is you or me, bro, it's gonna be you.
Oh man.
I was gonna continue on that note. If our listeners were to go back and read Of Mice and Men, do you think they would struggle with getting through the story because of its influence? Kind of like, let me give you an example so that they understand too what I'm saying. John Carter of Mars, right? From a sci-fi perspective, it's really hard for readers to go back and read John Carter because they've read John Carter of Mars their whole life, whether they've ever touched right. the book. Do you fear that, or is there? Do you think Mice and Men could suffer from some of that from a new reader?
Probably. You know, I think it's become it becomes a story that you know the plot even if you've never read it, because someone will say, I just want to tend the rabbits, George. You know, this notion of the pipe dream, this unavailable pipe dream, has permeated fiction for, I mean, it is the disintegration of the American dream. You know, that's what's happening in Of Mice and Men, the disintegration of the American dream. And so it's hard to read that book and be surprised by the turns, because it is the standard bearer of those things. It's the same with Grapes of Wrath or East of Eden at this mm-hmm. point too. And, you know, I think for a lot of sci-fi and fantasy, obviously, like, you read old Ray Bradbury and it reads like a cliche, because you don't realize, well, I mean, you and I do, but the common reader would not realize it reads like a cliche because Bradbury created it.
Yeah. Right.
You know? And, I mean, this is sort of the, the problem with the immediacy of common culture that we have now and social media and things of that nature, where there's no long-term discussion of a thing, right? You know, a thing is published today and we're going to tear it apart and look at every aspect of it tomorrow. And it doesn't have the time to actually, you know, permeate into something larger. We're going to look at every side of it. So for instance, recently there's like all this talk of like, oh, XYZ is Orwellian, ABC is Orwellian. Mm-hmm. All being said by people who don't know anything about Orwell, never read 1984, and didn't read any of his other essays either. They think that any dystopian notion is Orwellian. And so there was an article in USA Today written by my friend Barbara Vandenberg. She's my editor at USA Today too. I'm a book critic there. Where she interviewed my friend David Yulin and a former student of mine, Pallavi Yator, about what Orwellian really means. And of course, like, having a fascist say something is Orwellian is in itself Orwellian. Yep. and so that's like this notion of doublespeak and all these things. And, you know, people don't take the time to do the research to find out why a thing feels common. They just know it feels common. So the answer is yes. I think a book like Of Mice and Men would likely suffer at some point. But that's why I think you have to, you know, as a writer, I think you have to invest yourself in some classic literature to understand where these tropes come from. I mean, you see it so much more lately in TV and movies, where they repeat tropes of things that were common in the 1950s that don't have any relationship to reality anymore. And it's like, oh, this is a joke that was told on the Lucy Show in 1952, and it's being repeated on whatever bad sitcom is on CBS because it's a joke that just exists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there is that problem, I think, just in general with culture that becomes part of our sort of shared artistic DNA.
You know, that's where you might have an advantage with what you're writing right now, because in television, you still can't come from a space of empathy for the villain. And television hasn't been able to reflect that yet. So I think that's a great space still that exists in literature and hasn't been overly used, you know, into the main markets.
I don't know. I mean, look, you think about The Wire or The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or Get Shorty, the TV show, or Barry.
I hate all those shows.
or even 6 Feet Under. Like, you're talking about antiheroes in all of those situations. you know, even Dexter, which of course comes from a book as well.
Early dreaming.
There's twists on what the villain actually is. And so I think, you know, what I'm doing is probably more popular today than it would have been 25 years ago, because the only person doing it 25 years ago was Elmore Leonard.
Mm-hmm. Travis, you might actually like some of those shows because they have a theme.
Look. Okay, and every episode has a MacGuffin. I got it. I got it. Okay, I'm gonna go bury my head in my lawn later.
I mean, even you know, Game of Thrones, which of course is based on books as well. I think, you know, having villains with dimension is what has made this the golden age of television, because it's not so black and white anymore. You know, even the bad guy thinks he's the good guy. You know, that's something I think about when I write all the time. Like, don't write pure villains and pure heroes, because if you turn that story around, the villain, you know, isn't a Bond villain petting a white cat saying, "I will get you, Mr. Bond." You know, the villain's like, "Oh, I hate my mother, and I'm gonna show her by ruling the world, and that will be a very nice autocratic president," or whatever. You know, the bad guy thinks that they're doing good. They don't think they're doing bad.
True, true.
I just want to defend myself real quick. When I made that comment about television, I was referencing to the ungodly amount of CSI, Law and Order, TV shows. I totally forgot there were still a good handful of shows that do come from a semi-empathetic villain who I never see really is that good of a villain. They're not good villains yet.
Travis is all about the medical procedurals.
I hate the medical police procedurals. I hate those shows.
The tie-in ones that all go together. You know, I'm all excited about 911 and 911 Lone Star and the tie-in episode coming up next week.
Special Victims Unit, CSI, yeah, you know. CSI Miami, CSI New York. Oh my God. There's so many of them.
I mean, Travis, you're aware that there are shows that Mark Harmon doesn't star in that are available for you to watch.
Well, I watch some cartoons sometimes. He's not in those. Damn, I'm looking bad today. This is going to be the Greg episode. Greg was smart. He kept his mouth shut.
It was the intimidation factor of having Todd on the show. I just figured I'd be quiet and sit back and let Todd talk and let Travis open his mouth and put insert foot.
The key, guys, is to never invite someone on your show who knows more about what he's talking about than you do.
God damn it. That's a really good idea. From now on, only guys in Kickstarter campaigns.
The other day on Literary Disco, we had George Saunders on, and I was scared to death. I'm a huge George Saunders fan, and Ryder and Julia, my two co-hosts, the three of us were just like, "What are we going to say to George Saunders? We're so scared." And then he was so nice and so kind. He's not the kind of guy that would tell you, "You think I write fucking themes and MacGuffins?" He'd just agree, like, because he's just so nice and so polite. He just said, "Oh yeah, Lincoln and the Bardo. That was a MacGuffin. You're right about that." But I didn't learn anything from that, apparently.
Oh man! All right, we should probably start wrapping you up there, Todd, so I can get out of here with my dignity. Hopefully,
you lost that about 30 minutes ago.
Yeah, if that was the goal.
Who are you guys? Mostly of nightclubs, no writing.
Oh God!
All right. Todd, do you want to plug your book pretty good again?
I would love to. So my new book, The Low Desert, is out February 2nd. You can get it anywhere. You know where I like to shop, actually, is bookshop.org. That's where I do most of my book shopping, because it supports the independent booksellers. So go to bookshop.org. You can order the book. It will arrive at your house. Hey, if you want a signed copy, this is important. If you want a signed copy, you can order from Poisoned Pen or Mystery Ink, and that's with a with a K, Mystery Inc. They've got hundreds of signed books. I just got done signing all of them in my kitchen the other day. And it's a special keepsake, perfect for the holidays. When Easter rolls around, you want to have a signed book by someone named Goldberg in case Jesus comes back again. Like, I got a book by a Jew.
I'm okay.
It's signed.
Okay. It's in the basket.
Website or a blog you want people to visit?
Do I have a blog? I've got a very active live journal. I'd like you all to come visit.
I'm just saying.
In a MySpace account, you have a MySpace account. That's really important for the listeners. Listener.
Hey, Greg, you can't make jokes. A lot of our guys have blogs. Damn you!
No, I said MySpace account. MySpace account.
You can always follow me on Twitter at Todd Goldberg, Instagram at Todd Goldberg, Facebook at Todd Goldberg. If you want my blog, I'll have to go to Blogspot, see if they still have that design with the bubbles. I love that design with the bubbles. Do you guys get dudes on the show or like, let me talk to you about my blog. It's pretty active.
Again, it has your uncle.
Let's examine it. My uncle is almost 80 years old.
I'm just saying, and every week he sends me a link to his blog.
That's so creepy. Look, I want you guys to think about your futures here in this wild west of podcasting. I think every time you ask someone on the show live about either MacGuffins or blogs, you get like every teen that came to the show, they just go running away back to TikTok.
That's where I'm at usually.
Think so in the future.
All you need to do is type my name into the internet and you'll find me glaring into your soul with my dark noir heart. And you can find me there. And you can listen to Literary Disco wherever you get your fine podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere. Any of those places where people don't talk about blogs anymore because 2005 done come and gone. I tell you what, guys, I don't think George W. Bush has a great chance of getting reelected. I'm going to talk about that on my blog tomorrow night.
Oh, no, Travis.
That was awesome. All right. Todd, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Yes, thank you so much. You've made
my pleasure. Me
laugh so hard. I've had to put myself on mute like 20 times.
Anytime you guys want me back, I'm happy to come. And listeners, look, don't give Travis and Greg, or Travis really, don't give Travis a hard time for thinking I write Jessica Fletcher novels. It's not his fault.
I love Jessica Fletcher.
There's barely any information about me on the internet for him to find.
She solved a VR crime. A VR crime. What's the future?
Future. Well, apparently, Travis, we're not there yet in the future.
Oh, God.
All right, guys. We should go now. Thank you for listening. Greg, stop it.
I'm trying. The mouse fell asleep. I have to, you know, I mean, this is good stuff. This is the gold right here.
No fuss. We hit stop.
Hey, Gunslingers. Never Gunslingers is recorded, edited, and hosted by Travis Webb and Greg Smith. Produced by John Horsley. And found where all good things are found at The Spoilerverse. Follow us along at our IG, Twitter, and Facebook handles, Narrative Gunslingers. Thanks a lot, Gunslingers. We'll see you next time.